There you go with that.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hey, it's Riona Duncan, and I'm here with Professor Kathy Newman to talk about banned books on Forbes Avenue, and this is on WRCT Pittsburgh. Hello, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
The reason I'm talking with Professor Newman about banned books is because you run a banned books class. So how did you end up offering that class?
I don't remember what the initial inspiration was. I think the original title was Censored Texts. But starting about 20, 25 years ago, I just got interested in the phenomenon and I noticed that it was happening more and more. And then I got interested in the history of it. And every time you poke at a case of book banning, you find something different and you find something interesting. So I taught the class originally. I had like a set of texts that would change and the students would write papers on what we were reading. And then 6 years ago, I changed to the format I have now where students do original, in-depth, high-quality research on a single case of book banning. And I found that CMU students really rose to the occasion and did really good work. So I'm enjoying this new format.
What would you say you've learned from having this class?
It is so cool to see what students are interested in. I have students from all over the world, and so a lot of students want to work on books that were banned in their home country. So China, a student came up to me today and said she wanted to do a play that's been banned in Colombia. So I learn about books from all over the world. That's one super cool thing. And then I think students who choose books that have been banned more recently, I've helped students do things like find the video of the school board meeting where the book was banned. And so just getting to see human beings in action doing this thing that we kind of think of as nefarious or behind closed doors, like actually being able to see the school board meeting where it happened is really cool.
So you were talking about the trend that you noticed 25 years ago. Would you say that it still holds? Are we banning more books than we ever have?
I don't remember what I was inspired by 25 years ago exactly, but certainly since 2019, 2020, there has just been like a hockey stick graph. Like it is like right now, I would say is probably the most challenges in American history are happening to books right now. The group that really tracks that is PEN America. They come out with a report every 1 to 2 years. And so they're just showing that there's more and more parts of the country and more kinds of books and more different kinds of people who are challenging books. So I think I came up with the idea for this class and now it's really more relevant than ever before.
So I know there's a lot of people trying to combat that with social media, online library cards, that kind of thing.
Yes. I think sometime in the last couple of years, maybe the Brooklyn Public Library made it possible for anybody in the country to get a library card there, and then they could get electronic books or audiobooks. So I think, I mean, here, this is one of the ironies. In some ways, information has never been more accessible, more available, cheaper. And so it kind of raises the question, why challenge a book if somebody can just get it some other way? What is the political capital that's being expended? to say, I want this book out of this public library, or I want this book out of my kids' curriculum, or I want this book out of my kids' library. So I think the questions are in some ways more vexing now, because it just begs the question. And also, if you hand your 12-year-old a smartphone, why are you also trying to take a book out of that 12-year-old's classroom? It just doesn't make any sense.
No, although people on both sides of the political argument have decided to ban books for various reasons.
Definitely. There's not like one political group that has a monopoly on saying, I don't want my kid to read this book, or I don't want any kids to read this book. But there has been a more easy to track movement from American political conservatives since the Reagan era, and especially in the last 5 years. After Trump lost the 2020 election, there was an attempt by sort of the movement that was around Trump to attack school boards and to sort of take on cultural issues. And so critical race theory, books by diverse authors, books by queer authors, those books really started to come under attack kind of in the wake of that presidential loss.
So one of the reasons I'm talking to you today, beyond this being a great topic, is that we do have Banned Books Week coming up in late September. Do you feel like that celebration helps counteract this push towards book banning, or does it possibly kind of not do enough?
Yeah, there's a real irony that's present in both book banning and book defending. Banned Books Week was the brainchild of a librarian from Pittsburgh. Her name was Judith Krug, and she was she worked for the American Library Association, and she went to the American Booksellers Association and said, you know, we're seeing this uptake in challenges. Why don't we band together and promote the idea that we should have the freedom to read? And so at a big book convention in 1982, there was the first kind of celebration or recognition of banned books. And there's been one every year since 1982. I think the irony is that every year when Banned Books Week comes around, somebody writes an article that says there's no such thing as a banned book in America. And it's true that it's incredibly rare that any governmental agency will ever take action against a book. We don't live in a totalitarian country where you could be jailed for what you write, at least not today. And so there's some irony that the presence of Banned Books Week tends to sort of incite opposition to the use of the term banned books, and to the whole kind of, people say it's hysterical, it's sort of pearl clutching, it's much ado about nothing. At the same time, there's another ironic reaction, is that oftentimes when a book is targeted and then that target is publicized, that increases sales of the book. So the graphic novel Mouse was challenged by a Tennessee school board in January of 2022. And almost as soon as it was publicly known, that book just started flying off the shelves and they had to print some extra runs. So I think there's just irony on both sides. When you overtly try to defend books, you get attacked for sort of exaggerating the state of book banning. When you attack books, you often inadvertently promote them. There's an action and an opposite reaction that happens in both moves, both challenging and defending.
Given you've been studying banned books and teaching about them for so long, what would you say causes people to challenge them, especially when this causes such a counterswing to the other direction?
I mean, I think the positive that I see in book challenging is that it's a reminder, and a really happy reminder for me, because I'm an English professor, that books are powerful, that books incite strong emotions, that they make people want to do something, even if that thing is to close the book and try to take it away from other people. So I think it's evidence that in this kind of information saturated world, we still value books and we still find them to be life changing in a certain way. I think the other thing that I notice is that the internet and social media, I think, has allowed people to organize and exchange information at a much higher rate. So, for example, The Grapes of Wrath was banned by Kern County, California in 1939. And there was like a little 2-inch newspaper squib about it. And that newspaper squib got reprinted on a wire service. And so then a few other county libraries and city libraries took up the challenge and said, yes, we agree. We think Grapes of Wrath is offensive and we're going to ban it. In some cases, there's one library that burned it. They had a ceremonial burning of it. So the newspaper was kind of the viral media of the day. Today, if somebody challenges a book, it's often part of a list that circulates through political groups. There's a conservative political group called Moms for Liberty that has chapters in different states. And then book defenders also are organized on state levels. So there's ACLU chapters in many, many American cities. So I think what I'm noticing is that in some ways, even though it's probably more futile to challenge a book than ever before, people can share information about what books to target and how to attack them. It's easier to share that information than it's ever been in the history of books.
Would you say that graphic novels, for example, you mentioned Mouse, are especially easy to target with this then?
Absolutely. I mean, graphic novels are targeted, you know, I don't remember what the percentage differential is, but it's at a much greater rate than books that just have words on the page. I do think there's a famous judge who said, I don't know what art is versus pornography, but I know it when I see it. So we somehow trust our eyes to tell us if something is offensive or bad or wrong. And that visual information, we believe that we can adjudicate it in a way that we somehow maybe don't feel like we can adjudicate the written word in the same way. So graphic novels are constantly under attack. Anne Frank is a frequently banned book, The Diary of Anne Frank, but the graphic novel of The Diary of Anne Frank, banned and challenged even more. Things having to do with the Holocaust, like Mouse, Diary of Anne Frank, those have really been hot-button books in recent years. Other graphic novels that are under attack, genderqueer, coming-of-age memoir about a non-binary author, the most banned book in America, basically since the day it was published.
You mentioned that Holocaust and queer issues are a hot topic. Is there anything else that tends to be banned?
One of the people that we study in my class is one of the top banned book researchers in the U.S., and her name is Emily Knox. She teaches at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. So she's just a fantastic scholar, and she has a wonderful article about how when books get challenged, it tends to be diverse books that get challenged. And what she means by diverse books is books by authors who are considered to have some kind of marginal identity in that moment or in some past historical moment. So books by women, books by African-American authors, books by queer authors, books by Native American authors, Asian American, Indian American, Latino American, those books tend to be the most targeted. And Knox, I don't know if she would call herself a free speech absolutist, but she would really challenge anybody who wants to ban books, because her argument is ultimately if when bans and challenges go forward, they tend to fall on the text written by more marginal authors more than any other kind of author. So you might think, oh, I don't want To Kill a Mockingbird taught because the author used the N-word. But then it turns out that most books that are banned for the use of the N-word are written by African-American authors. So you might think that you have the best intentions when you're trying to get a book out of circulation, but the end result is that the people who get silenced are the people that we really need to hear from the most.
Thank you so much. I'm Riona. I'm here with Professor Kathy Newman talking about banned books. So I wanted to situate banned books in the larger context of free speech. How do banned books and free speech go hand in hand, do you think?
I love that question because I always start the class with the First Amendment. And I think that when students hear the word free speech, and if they haven't had to do AP Gov or, you know, some really intensive civics course, you just think, I have free speech. I can say whatever I want. And the First Amendment is 45 words, and not that many of those words are about free speech. And all it says is Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of the speech. And that actually isn't very specific and doesn't actually give you the freedom to say whatever you want. It only says that Congress shall make no law. So I really like to think about how kind of weird those 45 words are and how limited they are in terms of what we know how to do with them. One thing that is really shocking to me right now is how many state legislatures are passing laws against books. And the 1619 Project has been banned by at least a dozen state legislatures across the country. So I haven't seen any of those cases go up to the Supreme Court, but I sort of can't believe that we are actually passing laws against books, even despite the First Amendment. And I don't know if a state legislature is, I guess, distinct from Congress, but I honestly just don't understand it, can't figure it out. But I think that the openness, the vagueness, maybe the simplicity of the First Amendment does give us a real opportunity to think about what it means to have free speech and what the American Library Association calls the freedom to read. The ALA has a Reader's Bill of Rights or Library Bill of Rights that I teach in the class, and I can't recite it chapter and verse, but the basic idea is that you have the freedom to receive information. And I think that is much more comprehensive than simply the idea that Congress shall pass no law. Because if I have the freedom to receive information, if you have the freedom to receive information, then we can't be prevented from accessing a book in the library that a librarian has deemed appropriate or reading a book in a class that a teacher has deemed appropriate. We are free to receive that information. And I think one thing that's really interesting about this political moment is that many people have perceived the conservative party, the Republican Party in America, to be the party of freedom, of liberty. I don't want big government. I don't want to be taxed. I don't want to be told that I can't own or carry a gun. But that movement of liberty and freedom, going into schools and saying, you can't have this book in my child's classroom or in my child's school, seems to be sort of going against this message of freedom that we've been hearing for a long time. So I do think this is an exciting moment to think about what freedom is, freedom to and freedom from. And I think in some ways the freedom to receive information protects, if that was enshrined in our Constitution, it would protect us from the kinds of bans and challenges we're seeing so frequently right now.
Yeah, it's a really thorny issue, though, because even if Congress doesn't make any law or the government doesn't make any laws, there's still society which can kind of chill free speech. For example, cancel culture.
Yeah, I put cancel culture at the very end of the class and kind of save it for the last week because I find that 18 to 22-year-olds are pretty comfortable with the idea that we shouldn't be banning and challenging books, but are maybe more interested in canceling as a project. So I try to have us spend the whole semester looking critically at book banning and then thinking about what's the difference and what's the similarity. And I think I study the history of consumer activism, the history of boycotts. So I sort of put canceling a little bit more on the side of consumer culture. I don't want to read J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter books, somebody might say. You know, then you have kind of extreme versions of that where people were destroying their Keurigs sometime in the last few years because I think Keurig had a progressive advertising message or but the idea, like, I'm not going to buy this product because of what the product represents or because of what the author did and I don't agree with it. So I'm okay with consumer activism. I think it's fine. I do find that the accusation that somebody has been canceled tends to be overblown in the sense that a lot of so-called canceled people still have their platforms. I do think it's really interesting when it crosses over into labor. So I think the case I'm thinking of is the case of Amy Cooper, who met an African-American man named Chris Cooper in Central Park. She had her dog with her in an area where you're not supposed to have dogs because it's a bird area. He said, could you please take your dog out of here so I can watch birds? And she videoed him saying that, and she threatened to, she actually did call the police and say, there's an African-American man threatening me in the Ramble. I think that was the name of the area of the park. She was fired from her job. Should people lose their jobs because they were caught being racist and idiotic on social media? I don't know. That's a hard question for me. You do not have free speech at work. 100%. And I think, again, people come into my class thinking, oh, I have free speech. I can say whatever I want, wherever I want. Your employer can fire you for what you say. So I do get really interested in kind of the layers and contradictions that come out when you start thinking about the similarities and the differences between banned books and cancel culture.
Taking it back a little closer to banned books, people can also be fired for perhaps giving a child access to a book. So I feel like that also verges onto labor.
It does. Teachers and librarians are just under so much duress right now for being in the public eye around these issues. They are getting threatened with arrest, you know, more kind of garden variety bullying, death threats, digital harassment, that sort of thing. So yeah, I'm definitely against that. I mean, I think these are professionals who have training in how to tell if a book is actually age appropriate. And I am someone who is very likely to trust professionals in this situation. I mean, granted, I am a professional teacher myself, but I am not paid by the state of Pennsylvania. I am paid by the undergraduates of Carnegie Mellon. So I do think that people are really having to become heroes when they just went to school to be a teacher or a librarian. And it's really tough right now for those folks.
I feel like, for example, the American Library Association, by hosting Banned Books Week, is somewhat seen to have taken a political side.
I think the ALA organizations like PEN America, if you look at their public rhetoric, I mean, they are very careful to say that they're against book bans, no matter who is launching it. I know in California, progressive parents have banded together to challenge books like To Kill a Mockingbird or Huckleberry Finn, again, for, you know, inadequately respectful portrayals of African Americans and use of the N-word. So you could say that was a liberal or left book ban. I think that when I look at the numbers, they just don't compare in a balanced way. So at least right now, I would say liberals are not going about the work of book banning and challenging to the extent that conservatives are.
Well, conservatives seem, per my observations, to be a bit more uptight about sexuality in texts.
I think something like 80 to 90% of most book challenges come around the question of obscenity, age appropriateness, portrayals of sex and sexuality. So I think as we've had a real, what I see is real positive movement in having more public gay authors telling queer stories, there has been, I think, a conservative backlash against that. I think there is a fear, and I don't think this fear even has like a politics per se, that your kids might learn something at school that will lead them to do something you don't want them to do. And I know that, you know, that's something I've struggled with as a parent. You know, especially public schools, like ideally they're going to be exposed to thoughts, ideas, authors, points of view that aren't available in a single family. To my mind, that's the whole point of the project of public education. And, you know, something when we were talking before about free speech and rights, I think one of the things that the Constitution doesn't tell us how to do is what happens when my right to free speech interferes with, say, some other right that I might possess. So I do think that we don't have a formula. We don't have a mathematical formula for figuring out whose rights trump other people's rights. Maybe you could answer a question for me, which is when you started the banned books class last fall, like, what was your thought on kind of the issue and how did that change over the course of the semester? How are you thinking about it now?
I'm from Chicago. So originally I thought, well, you know, that doesn't happen here, which isn't actually true even. And people who are banning books are just doing it because they feel that they can't control their children. But I feel like I did gain more sympathy for the perspective. Even if I don't necessarily agree with banning books, I do see why, well, age appropriateness, I would leave it to the professionals, but I do see the arguments for that being a major problem.
Yeah, I'm happy you said that because I do challenge my students every fall to try and imagine some scenario in their life. I mean, you know, most of you aren't really even at the point where you're even thinking about having children. I think that something really changed for me when I had kids. You know, I just saw the education system differently than when I was in it myself. So to imagine some kind of scenario where you might really disagree with somebody who wants to teach your kid something. So I think I do encourage everybody to try to empathize and take the position of and imagine being so upset about something that you could get very political about it.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to end this. So this has been Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm Riona Duncan, and I've got Professor Kathy Newman here with me. We were talking about banned books. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. It's lovely to speak with you.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.
Hey, y'all, what's up? It has been 37 days since Donald Trump took office, and a lot has been going on every single one of those 37 days. Yeah, and you could be feeling a lot of things about that, but more than anything, you might be feeling overwhelmed, but whatever you're feeling, I want you to know that you should never feel alone. So for the first 100 days, I'm going to be coming to you once a month with a general recap of how Americans are feeling, with polls and data provided by Navigator Research. So these posts will also be nonpartisan. I'm just going to give you a lay of the land. I always think it's important for you to be able to inform your own opinions and make your own judgment calls. And what better way to do that than discussing the relevant data? So without further ado, let's get into it. Need my notes. So as we know, it is tax season. Yeah, and we've heard a lot of things, whether it's about Donald Trump trying to get rid of the IRS and create an ERS, whatever that means. But more than anything, what we've heard from the White House's messaging that we'll provide more tax cuts to the rich and create cuts to programs that our taxes would typically fund that would benefit the middle and lower classes. Here's what Americans are saying. Trump's alignment with tech CEOs is concerning. Most people, 90%, want tax cuts for the middle class instead. 69% of Americans believe tech CEOs are influencing Trump's administration, and it's seen across all racial groups, 68% in white folks, 66% black, 76% Hispanic, AAPI 77%, so it's not even that. 41% of Americans think Trump will help his billionaire friends get richer instead of helping the middle class, and 80% of Americans say CEOs, billionaires, and foreign investors should not get tax cuts. And speaking of his allegiance to tech billionaires, Elon Musk, his numbers are also dipping as far as favorability. As I'm sure you know, once Trump was put in office, he gave Elon Musk a new department, a Department of General Efficiency, to which he was able to access Americans' private information, our Social Security, the Department of Education, Department of Treasury, and since has laid off several federal employees. And a number of federal programs, once again, have been taking funding cuts. And while he might have landed at a 47% in unfavorability in October of 2024, he's now at 53%, and that might seem like a big jump, but generally Americans do not want tech billionaires calling shots or meddling in policy, period. Now, with all that said, basically Americans are feeling that Trump is focused on himself, doing what's best for himself. 53% of Americans feel that way. A lot of Americans feel like he's just bringing corruption to D.C., that whole the January 6th pardon. 48% of Americans do not like that or feel negatively about that. 44% of Americans feel negatively about the funding freeze. And my biggest takeaway from all these numbers is that even though the election results would lead one to believe that the majority of Americans feel one way, as time passes for sure, discontent is brewing across Americans, regardless of race, class, gender, socioeconomic status, or any walk of life. So, yeah, we'll check back in next month. And if you feel like these numbers were helpful, please visit Navigator's Instagram and their website to see what poll information they have available to you now. Thank you.
You're not acting grateful enough. You're not being thankful. Donald Trump, to the leader of Ukraine. Joining our ongoing coverage, former United States Ambassador to the United Nations, former National Security Advisor to President Obama, Ambassador Susan Rice is here. Ambassador, your reaction.
Well, Nicole, obviously it's a very sad day and an embarrassment for the United States on the world stage. But let's step back and analyze what's happened here. I think there's no question that this was a setup. You heard Donald Trump say at the end of that clip you played, this is great television. This was a setup. Volodymyr Zelensky was compelled to agree to a horrible deal that would have sent Ukraine's minerals to the United States without any concrete security guarantees. And yet, because he was trying to improve a relationship with Donald Trump, he came to Washington, he came to the Oval Office, and sat down for a meeting, hat in hand. And soon after he got there, the vice president of the United States lit into him and started a confrontation. Now, I've been in countless Oval Office meetings with heads of state, presidents, and vice presidents. as National Security Advisor, as UN Ambassador, and in other roles. I can tell you that the Vice President or the Secretary of State or anybody else, they don't jump in, hijack a conversation without the express blessing of the President of the United States. So J.D. Vance did that deliberately. Donald Trump knew what he was going to do. And I think, as he said at the end, because he can't, you know, help himself, this was a setup for the cameras. It was a play to his base. But above all, it was a play to Vladimir Putin, to show fealty to Vladimir Putin, and to try to humiliate Zelensky. But Zelensky didn't play along with the script, because Zelensky's got dignity and guts. And Zelensky has people that he democratically represents. And as a result, he couldn't sit there in silence as lies were being told about how the war was started, whose responsibility it was, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And he tried to explain what is in fact the case. To suggest that he was not thankful, I can't count the number of times that Zelensky has thanked the American people, the American government, the President of the United States for the critical support that we've provided. It's not about gratitude. It was an effort to humiliate him, to scuttle the U.S.-Ukraine relationship so that Trump no longer feels any obligation to provide support and to hand U.S. interests and Ukraine and potentially Europe to Putin on a silver platter.
Why?
That's a great question.
Susan, we're gonna unfreeze you. I want to play some more of the president in the Oval Office if we have more of that. We're trying to Ambassador, you're unfrozen.
I hope so.
I say why, and I'll add this: Trump had so much to say about everything he and Putin had been through together. It was like a dictator's version of "We Can Do Hard Things." If you're familiar with that podcast, it was insane.
Yeah, Nicole, I think we have to understand that what happened today is really a piece of a larger puzzle. We've seen this building, frankly, since before Trump returned to office. But literally so much of what he has done in his first 5 weeks in office have been to the benefit of Russia and China. So let's review the bidding. You know, threatening our ally, Denmark and Greenland. You know, starting a trade war with our closest allies and partners, trying to, you know, create a conflict with Canada and trying to pretend to relegate it to the 51st state. Vance going to Munich and basically trying to blow up the NATO alliance, pulling the United States Agency for International Development 100% off the map and retreating. Proposing to cut 8% a year from the Department of Defense and literally dismantling the federal government and eviscerating it. That is not in any way, shape, or form in the national security interests of the United States. We are not only alone and alienated from our closest allies in Europe and Asia, as we heard from Turnbull, but worse, we have aligned ourselves completely with Russia, who is aligned with China, North Korea, and Iran. So in 5 weeks, we flipped the script, and we are dangerously isolated and cast our lot with adversaries who truly do not have our interests at heart.
I mean, Andrew Nastios, who was the head of USAID for George W. Bush, was on the program and made the argument that USAID keeps us safe from... It kept us safe from another 9/11 in the years after 9/11, because by stemming catastrophe and human suffering, you also counter extremism in some of the most brutal and hostile corners of the globe. That aid isn't just philanthropic, which seems to be Donald Trump's misunderstanding of it, that aid is one of our most mighty soft power tools, not just for ending human suffering, but for keeping us safe here. Another person described this as the worst 24 hours in modern American history, that we dismantle programs to spare children from dying of malaria and measles, mumps, preventable deaths and diseases, and we dismantle the World Alliance. What is Trump's end game if you're an adversary or an ally looking at everything he's doing?
I think his end game is to undermine the security and stability of the United States. And that brings us back to the question that you asked earlier. Why? There's no other way to look at this in sum, Nicole, than to see that this is a deliberate and comprehensive weakening of the United States in very short order, from a security point of view, from an economic point of view, from a diplomatic point of view, all to the benefit of our principal adversaries, Russia primarily, and China. And so I think the sooner the American people understand what this is about, what this is at what's at stake, the clearer we can be. Now, Vladimir Putin is not popular in the United States. 80% of Americans understand him to be the vicious, cruel dictator that he is. But I'd love to hear more than one Republican in Congress stand up and say that this is not who the United States is. This is not what we signed up for. And more importantly, this is not making America safer. It's, in fact, making us weaker and shrinking in the world. And it is going to make every American less safe.
I mean, before the Oval Office ambush, Republicans were on the record as recently as last week criticizing Putin, calling him what he is, and praising Zelensky. At least one Republican senator, I think it's Mr. Wicker, deleted a tweet today and got in line with almost the same. This is Senator Wicker, deleted a tweet highlighting the meeting with Zelensky and the bipartisan group of senators this morning, which he said went swimmingly. It went great. Zelensky was impressive and courageous and brave. And Democrats and Republicans left that meeting with high praise for Zelensky. He deleted this tweet praising Zelensky after Trump and Vance berated him in what you describe as a setup. What does that send to the world, that message?
Well, it's tragic. You know, Senator Wicker knows better. So do many of the senators on both sides of the aisle that participated in that meeting earlier.
There's that tweet up on the screen again. This was from this morning's. Republican Senator Wicker tweeted, "Today, several U.S. senators had the opportunity to meet with President Zelensky to discuss Ukraine's future and the mineral deal brokered by President Trump. This is a huge step forward in securing mutual prosperity and peace for Americans and Ukrainians." Senator Wicker tweeted that and then deleted it, Susan Rice.
And deleted it knowing better, as do so many of his Republican colleagues, as well as Democrats. And they are just kowtowing to a leader out of fear and cowardice and selling out the national interests in the process. I, you know, for all this talk we've heard for decades about how strong and muscular Republicans are on national security and defense, how they stand for freedom, as Ronald Reagan did, and up for democracy, they have just folded. And they are complicit in the undermining of our national security and our national interests.
What are your worries about what happens now? Now that Putin and Vance have done this, we're at the hinge point, right? It will forever be for Ukraine what happened before that meeting and what happens after. What is the risk now for the Ukrainian people?
Well, I worry about the Ukrainian people. I worry about Europe, and I worry about the wider world. For the Ukrainian people, they have no choice but to continue to do all that they can to defend themselves. They are facing an extremely powerful and hostile aggressor who now twice has invaded their country, and they're right to believe he'll do it again if given the opportunity. So they're going to have no choice except to continue to defend themselves. And one can hope that there might be some path to patching things up, but I think that's very hard to envision. I don't think Donald Trump wants that. I think he wants the outcome he got today. And that means that Europe and our other Democratic allies or erstwhile allies will need to do as much as they possibly can to continue to support Ukraine. People don't recall that Europe already has provided more billions more in assistance to Ukraine than the United States has, economic and military. They're going to need to continue to carry the load while the United States casts its lot with Vladimir Putin.
Hi, I'm Dr. Michael Norman, your health tip of the day from the African American Wellness Project. Infections like polio, smallpox, and measles used to be as common as coronaviruses today. But now we have life-saving vaccines for those and other diseases. Sadly, too many children still go unvaccinated. Choosing to delay or refuse vaccine puts your child and other children at serious risk. So talk to your child's doctor today about vaccines. And for more information, visit aawellnessproject.org.
Now, opening the vaults on over 100 years of recorded music history. Welcome to Cruisin' the Decades Global Edition. One song per decade, 100 years of music in 1 hour. Get ready to go cruising through 100 years of popular music. This is a journey through music history from someone with a rather ridiculous record collection. Here's your host for Cruisin' the Decades, Brad Savage. Brad Savage.
This is where the magic happens. Musical history, recorded sound, and the miracle of radio broadcasting. Welcome to Cruisin' the Decades, episode number 151, cruisinthedecades.com. And on today's show, remembering Mick Ralphs and Lou Christie, plus a well-beloved song of the musical My Fair Lady. In 1985, on the big screen and in Motown with producer Rick James. And a song unlike anything else in the psychedelic late 60s, a song I only recently discovered with a little help from our close personal friends, the Black Keys. It's Cruisin' the Decades, one song per decade. We'll begin in 1912 with a very delightful love song by two of the biggest pop singers of the teens and 20s, Ada Jones and Billy Murray, together. This is so delightful. It's called Be My Little Bumblebee. I'm Cruisin' the Decades.
Billy Bumble used to mumble round the rosemary,
where she would meet him, greet him, and then treat him to some honey sprees.
Then start a buzzing in a dozen different loving keys. Be my little baby bumblebee.
Buzz around, keep a buzzing round.
Bring home all the honey love to me.
Little bee, little bee, little bee.
Let me spend the happy hours roving with you amongst the flowers. And when we get where no one else can see,
cuddle up, cuddle up, cuddle up.
Be my little baby bumblebee.
Buzz around, keep a buzzing round.
We'll be just as happy as can be.
You and me, you and me, you and me.
Honey, keep a buzzing, please. I've got a dozen cousin bees,
but I want you to be my baby bumblebee.
Papa Bee said, goodness me, and Mama said, we'll see.
If you can pay your way for every day, the price of honey grows dear.
But little Queenie said, that's for Sweeney, and whispered in his ear, be my little baby bumblebee.
Buzz around, keep a buzzing round.
Bring home all the honey love to me.
Little bee, little bee, little bee.
Let me spend the happy hours roving with you amongst the flowers. And when we get where no one else can see,
cuddle up, cuddle up, cuddle up.
Be my little baby bumblebee.
Buzz around, keep a buzzing round.
We'll be just as happy as can be.
You and me, you and me, you and me.
Honey, keep a buzzin', please. I've got a dozen cousin bees,
but I want you to be my baby bumblebee.
You can hear the improvements in recording technology and the evolution of musical styles of popular music through the decades and beyond. Over 100 years of music. This is the global edition of Cruisin' the Decades, broadcast worldwide on AM, FM, and shortwave.
With 100 years of music and music history appreciation. That's quite a remarkable selection right there. That's from guitarist Sylvester Weaver. It's called Guitar Rag. Beautiful instrumental from 1923. Cruising the decades, moving into the 1930s with a great large band, Andy Kirk and his 12 Clouds of Joy. And he was one of just a handful of black band leaders in the big band era. This is called Until the Real Thing Comes Along on Cruising the Decades, 1936.
I would work for you, I'd slave for you, I'd be a beggar or a knave for you. If
WRCT Pittsburgh, music for your inner robot.